Stand, please. Oyez, oyez, oyez. All persons having business before the Honorable of the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia, I admonish you, God, and you, and your fair attention, for the court is now sitting. That day of the United States, and Honorable, please be seated.
Case number 14-5220. Jeffrey LeBeau, appellant versus United States Department of Justice. Mr. Light for the appellant, Mr. Interante for the appellee.
Good morning.
Good morning. Jeffrey Light on behalf of appellant Jeffrey LeBeau. May it please the court. In this FOIA case, there are several exemptions at issue, as well as the procedure for adjudicating FOIA's exclusion provision. I'd like to start by addressing Exemption 3 as it applies to the Pen Register statute. The court's first task in assessing whether Exemption 3 statute, whether an asserted statute is an Exemption 3 statute, is to look at the threshold question of whether that statute is a non-disclosure statute at all. In this respect, the Pen Register statute has two provisions that may be relevant. One requires a court or directs the court entering the Pen Register order to place that order under seal. The second is a non-disclosure provision, which only applies to the recipient of the order, that is the telephone company, essentially, that they not disclose the existence of the order. Neither of these provisions, however, direct the government not to disclose the information. There hasn't been a single case from this court in which the court has found a statute to qualify under Exemption 3 where the alleged non-disclosure portion didn't say anything about the government.
So the government could release a document that the district court has placed under seal?
That's correct. And that depends on what the terms of the sealing order are. So as this case...
This order shall not be released, period.
Well, this court has explained that seals operate differently and that the mere existence of a seal is not enough. In this case, there's no evidence at all about what the seal says. The only thing that we know is that the seal was issued pursuant to the statute. And so we can make certain guesses about what it says based on that. That is, it probably has all the information that the statute requires it to have, but there's no information that there's anything beyond that. And the information that the statute requires it to have is fairly minimal. The name of the person on whose line the pen register is being placed, their phone number, and even those things only if they're known. So we have almost no information to go off of here.
Wait, so I'm not following. If under D1 it says the order shall be order be sealed unless otherwise ordered by the court?
Yeah. Correct.
And so if there has been no otherwise order by the court, and so the pen register order itself is sealed, then your view is that the government can nonetheless release it publicly?
So the question, yes, that would be our position. But at any rate, there is not in this case a pen register order at issue. That's not the document that we're talking about here. The document at issue here is an FBI document that describes how a pen register was placed onto a phone.
Right, but in addressing the threshold question of whether this is a statute that even comes within the fold of...
That's correct.
Then you'd have to say that, at least with respect to the order itself. So I take your point. I get your point that we're not talking about the order itself. We're talking about documents that are surrounding the order. But with respect to the order itself, you're suggesting that we read the statute that says that the order be sealed to mean that the order be sealed, but that the government can still disclose the order.
There could be some cases in which the terms of the seal or the context in which it was issued might suggest that the government cannot disclose it. But in the absence of any information at all in the record about what's in the seal, the court doesn't, there's just not a sufficient record to have granted summary judgment to the government in this case. If the seal simply says this order shall be sealed, the mere existence of a seal is not enough to show that the government itself is prohibited from disclosing it. And that was this court's clear holding in Morgan is, moreover, that the government is the one that bears the burden of showing that seal is intended to prohibit the agency from disclosing the records. In this case, it seems clear to me that the purpose of the seal would be to prevent the individual who's being investigated from going to the court and finding out that they're investigated by looking through public court records. It's not clear what purpose would ever be served by a pen register order, sealing order, that prohibits the government from doing what it pleases with the order itself. That is, if the government wanted to, if the FBI wanted to give this information to a witness or to another agency or to a foreign government, that they couldn't do it without permission of the district court. That's something that would inhibit the ability of law enforcement to do its job, and that clearly wasn't the intention of passing the statute. In fact, the legislative history makes clear that one of the reasons for this statute was to allow the government the ability to gather some preliminary information to help it develop probable cause for further investigation.
What about Mr. Hardy's declaration where he says, this is JA-93, the information withheld under Exemption 3 consists of details surrounding FBI's SA's making arrangements to set up and install and trap. That's talking about, as I understand it, what you describe as prong two, which clearly isn't directed to the government.
Well, the other thing is the non-disclosure portion relating to the telephone companies.
I thought that's what you described as prong two.
You're right. Mm-hmm. And so with respect to that, that is targeted specifically at the telephone companies.
So I'm reading Mr. Hardy's declaration where he says that some of the information that was withheld, this is paragraph 73,
right,
consists of details surrounding arrangements. Isn't that prong two, not prong one?
So that would...
details surrounding arrangements to set up and install a pen register and trap device during a criminal investigation?
So, yeah, that would perhaps be more relevant to the non-disclosure portion, but that non-disclosure portion, by its terms, the statute, is not directed at the government.
Well, I'm assuming that the government is going to argue that, well, what the next sentence says, that what they withheld were the identities and phone numbers of the individuals subject to the pen register. Is there any indication they withheld more?
You know, it's a little unclear what Mr. Hardy's saying, because if we look at the actual documents, it appears that they have revealed. I mean, the government's already revealed the existence of a pen register in this case. They asserted the exemption. That's
right.
How we know about it. And if you look at in the supplemental appendix, this is LeBeau 329, the last paragraph there, where the B3-1 is asserted, clearly identifies this individual, Mr. Kuhn, and his phone number there within the context of talking about the arrangements for the pen register. So it does appear that there is something beyond the identity of the individual and the phone number that is being protected by the government
here. And you find that from what? I'm looking at this last paragraph.
Right, and it identifies this individual. So the beginning and end part, it looks like, or at least the beginning part of that paragraph, It's withheld under B3-1, the pen register.
You're talking about the bottom of a page?
The bottom of page 329.
Right.
And then...
And what does that identify other than the identities and phone numbers of individuals subject to the pen register?
Well, that's what it does. It identifies that. So that,
and nothing more?
Right. The
All right.
But that's already identified. What they're withholding then is something beyond the identity of the individual.
And we know that because?
Because they've already revealed the identity. So what it is they're withholding is obviously not the identity.
Okay. And let me just be clear. They had revealed the identity at the time of this first affidavit?
They didn't. They don't believe that this document was revealed until
That's my point.
Appeal.
All right. So that at the time Mr. Hardy prepared this declaration, they hadn't revealed what you just showed me on supplemental 329.
I can't be, I'm sorry, I can't be positive of
the date
that this
was revealed.
All right,
I'm not trying to. I just wanted to see what indication we had that something more was being withheld. That's all.
Well, it is also, I mean, there is the sentence in the Hardy Declaration referring to the name and identity, but then there's also the portion that talks about the details of the installation of the pen register. And at least that portion, it is clear, is unrelated to the things that would typically go into a pen register order based on what the statute says. Does the court have more questions about the pen register, or I continue on to the grand jury?
You're out of time, but go ahead with the grand jury.
Excuse me?
Go ahead with the grand jury.
Okay. I'm sorry. I see I'm out of time. Well, just to put it very briefly then, our position is that even though a grand jury subpoena could be categorically withheld, in this case, the government is attempting to immunize the information that was provided to the grand jury from FOIA by affirmatively stating that the information was given to the grand jury. Had it just been released to us, there's no way that we would have known among all the hundreds of pages of information that was released that this was grand jury material.
So in the second Hardy Declaration, at JA 132 to 133, the statements made that to the extent that any such documents were presented to a grand jury, they were not withheld merely because of such presentation. So if that's true, doesn't that account for what you just said?
So that quote, I think, was intended to address our argument that the mere existence of something being to the grand jury doesn't immunize it.
Yeah.
And so his response is, well, there were other reasons for presenting it to the grand jury. What that doesn't address is whether the documents on their face are associating it with the grand jury. We only know that the documents are associated with the grand jury because Mr. Hardy's now told us that.
Right, but I thought your point is that in the first Hardy Declaration, the indication is made that certain documents were not turned over because they were submitted to the grand jury.
Right.
And mere submission to the grand jury wouldn't be enough under our cases if the documents had an independent existence and there would be a way to disclose them without revealing that they were bound up with the grand jury. Right, that's your argument.
That was the initial argument, right?
And then I thought that the Hardy Declaration, the part that I just quoted, is a response to that, because it says they were not withheld merely because of this presentation, i.e. presentation to the grand jury. And so it seems like the assertion's being made that you're not right. You might have been able to read the first Hardy Declaration to support the argument that you're making, but in the second Hardy Declaration, we, the government, have now cleared up that merely the presentation of information to the grand jury isn't enough for us to withhold it. We recognize that, but that's not why we're withholding it. It would reveal something about the scope of the grand jury investigation or something like that, which I think you would agree is something that need not be revealed.
Right. I mean, if the documents on their face would reveal the inner workings, but It wasn't even said that. It was said that they could reveal the inner workings. And further, while Mr. Hardy, I guess, clarified the applicable standard, but statement is far too conclusory, just saying, if we gave you this, it would reveal the inner workings of, or could reveal the inner workings of the grand jury, doesn't provide a sufficient basis for the plaintiff or the court to make a determination whether that's correct or not.
But why? Because if it's true that it could, does it have to be shown that it in fact would? I mean, if there's a risk, if there's a danger that it would reveal the scope of a grand jury investigation or something like that, is that not enough?
Well, I guess they wouldn't have to say it with absolute certainty.
Right.
But simply saying it could is, on the other hand, too vague. Anything could have that ability.
So it has to be north of could, but south of would.
Somewhere in there.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. I mean, at least it just needs to be something upon which the court can make a determination whether it's reasonable. It's not really so much whether Hardy says could or would. It's the substance of what he's...
Now, if the documents are such, if there are documents, and if the documents are such that they have a stamp on them that indicates that they were subpoenaed by the grand jury or issued to the grand jury, then looking at the documents would reveal. So then in that situation, you would agree that that's not something that needs to be disclosed.
Right. I mean, if there's a clear indication on the face of the document, this is something that was presented to a grand jury.
Even if the document has an independent existence, it may be that the only copy that the government has is one that's stamped as of consequence to the grand jury.
If it has an independent existence, then the government's burden is a little bit different. But in general, if the document would reveal what's going on and it's stamped, that should be sufficient.
Okay.
We don't have that information here.
Yeah.
Thank you.
I wanted to ask you about the exclusion argument.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So with the exclusion argument, you're...
No, he's coming in. Yeah.
Is that right to proceed?
Oh, yeah. I was just asking if she had any.
Oh, thanks. With the exclusion argument, your position is that the procedure that should be followed is something that mimics the Glomar procedures.
In a very narrow class of cases, this being one of them, something similar to the Glomar procedure would be possible, and would best serve the interests of the adversary system. Yes.
So, can I ask you just the following hypothetical? So, suppose you have a situation in which the individual who's making the request files something that says, "Look, to the extent that there's documents that are being withheld under this exclusion, on the theory that there's an investigation that I don't know about, I actually know about it." So, which is, I think, the thrust of your submission. So that can't be the basis for withholding the documents from me because it's an investigation about which I know, right?
Well, so the question would then be, how speculative is that claim? If it's purely speculative, no. In this case, we have sworn deposition testimony from FBI agents, so it's far from speculative.
Right. So let's just give you the benefit of the doubt for purposes of spinning this out. So the benefit of the doubt such that it's true that you, in fact, know an investigation and you show that you know of it with sufficient objective evidence that, you know, we can be reliably assured that you know of the investigation. But then suppose that there's a second investigation that you don't know about and the documents that are being requested are kind of commingled so that they deal with both investigations. Well, in that situation, how would your suggested process work out?
So what would happen is the district court would adjudicate the issue as framed by the plaintiff. So plaintiff says, I know about this particular investigation, and if that is the basis for the withholding, then the government needs to turn over the information. The district court then says, for example, I agree with you. If that is the basis for the withholding, they would need to turn it over. The documents then would not be turned over because there was a second independent basis for it. So the government would respond, that's not our basis. So you wouldn't get the documents and you still wouldn't know what the basis was or was not.
What does the government say in its response? They would I take it that in, they would have to file, the court by hypothesis doesn't know about what's in the documents at this point, right? Because
right.
we're not talking, we're not at the point yet where there's been an in-camera investigation of the documents.
Right.
So what would the government say in response in the circumstance in which the reason that it's withholding, the hypothetical reason it's withholding the documents is that they might reveal the existence of a second investigation as to which the individual who's the subject of it hasn't shown that he
right.
or she knows?
The government would have two choices there, neither of which would include revealing the existence of the second investigation. They could
uh-huh.
either say, plaintiff, we agree with you as a matter of law. If that was our basis, we would have to turn it over to you. Or they would say, we disagree with you. If that was our basis, it would be justified. The district court would then adjudicate that issue. And if the hypothetical matches the reality, then the agency turns it over. If it doesn't match because the agency has some other basis for withholding it, then the agency would not turn it over. And that would be the end of the issue.
So from your perspective, the government could respond just by saying, that's not our basis.
Yeah.
At that level of generality, without any indication that, you know, something to the effect of, well, it's true that knowledge of an investigation would be enough, but there may or may not be other investigations.
I mean, as long as if the parties agree as a matter of law on the issue, then if there's no question of fact at issue, then that would be it. If there is a question of fact at issue, like there was in Benavidez, where there was a question of, I think it was about an informant, how much information is enough to show that the informant was officially confirmed? So if there was a question here, how much information is enough to show that you actually know about the investigation, then that could be litigated. The hypothetical you posed to me, though, we assume
yeah.
that had been met.
Yeah.
So that's why I was saying, just as a matter of law, that's all they would have to say, is that's not our basis, and then that would be the end of it.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right, we'll give you a couple minutes in reply.
Thank you.
Mr. Interante.
Good morning. May it please the court. Counsel, John Interante for the Department of Justice. The court should affirm the district court's grant of summary judgment in favor of the Department of Justice. As the district court correctly held, the FBI properly asserted Exemption 3 to withhold information obtained pursuant to a pen register order, which must be sealed pursuant to the pen register statute, and also to withhold material obtained pursuant to grand jury subpoenas, which may not be disclosed subject to Criminal Rule 6E, and the district court, I'll limit my comments to the issues actually addressed by appellant, the district court did not abuse its discretion in following the well-established procedure of reviewing in-camera ex parte declarations provided by the FBI to address Mr. LeBeau's speculative claim that the FBI invoked a statutory exclusion under FOIA.
On the pen register, can we start with the pen register?
Absolutely.
On the pen register, the Hardy Declaration at JA 93, I guess, paragraph 73, says here the information withheld from disclosure pursuant to Exemption 3 consists of details surrounding FBI SAs making arrangements to set up and install a pen register and trap and trace the device during a criminal investigation.
Right.
And then what the statute talks about is disclosure of the pen register itself.
Well, the statute describes the pen register order. First, as to the issue of non-disclosure, the statute is entitled Non-Disclosure of Existence of Pen Register or a Trap and Trace Device. It's clearly a non-disclosure statute. And the pen register order is described in the statute as one authorizing or approving the installation and use of a pen register or a trap and trace device. And the court is directed by statute that the order be sealed until otherwise ordered by the court. That's clearly evidence of congressional intent precluding the government from disclosing any information about the existence and use of a pen register or trap and trace device. And the information withheld was limited to that.
What? No, but why are you saying all of that? Because what the statute says is the order be sealed. So isn't there a gap? Or maybe there's not a gap. As I read the declaration, It says here the information withheld from disclosure consists of details surrounding FBISA's making arrangements to set up and install a pen register.
Which would extend to the existence of a pen register. That's material.
There must be an existence of a pen register because the exemption's been invoked.
Correct.
Based on a pen register.
And information surrounding the existence of the register itself was disclosed under Exemption 3 to provide information about the application process, which incorporated into an order we would submit, would also be sealed by the order itself.
But you just said incorporated into the order. Is it actually incorporated into the order? Maybe you can't say, but it just seems to me that there's a difference between the order itself and what the declaration is talking about. Are you saying that there is a difference, but let me ask this. Are you saying that there is a difference, but that difference doesn't matter because everything is subject to non-disclosure, or are you saying there's actually no difference because the stuff that's described in paragraph 73 is, in fact, part of the order?
Well, the application for a pen register, and I want to stay with the record, would be ex parte, presumably if the order entered is sealed. So any information to the extent that it preexisted the issuance of the order we would submit is part of the order.
Part of the
adopts
order?
That. It's part of the order, yes. I mean, it would be part of the application to the extent it predated.
Right, but that gets to the nub of the issue. Is that the government's position, that all of that stuff is actually part of the order that's to be sealed?
It would be part of, yes, that it would be subject to the non-disclosure provision of the pen register statute. For the government to release, for the government to release information about the application or any information predating the issue of the order would disclose the existence of the order, presumably.
So the government asked for, 20 locations, and the district court says, I approve 5, and puts that in the order under seal. And your position is all 20 are sealed. And so as Mr. Hardy states, you draw no distinction between the first part of the statute and the second part, namely the first part referring to the order under seal and the second part referring to people who are installing the telephone company, not disclosing anything relating to what they're doing pursuant to this order.
Correct. I mean, the position would be that the application for a pen register order, if it describes certain instrumentality numbers that were not incorporated into the order, to release that information would, in effect, disclose information about the subsequent order that was issued, because part of the order.
Well, the order, my hypothetical, the order only talks about 5 locations. And that's under seal. So that's what the government is authorized to do. And you're saying it wouldn't make sense. I'm putting words in your mouth, but I just need to understand what the government's position is, that if it were disclosed that you asked for 20,
correct,
and only 5 were approved, and then the 15 were disclosed, then the public would know where the other 5 were. Is that your position?
I believe that would be the case. I don't think that's these facts here.
Well, Mr. Hardy's declaration that Judge Srinivasan has been focusing on is a little unclear about this, because he's blended these two prongs together. And we're just trying to understand how you're reading this statute.
If the court's hypothetical were the case, which I don't believe it is the case, then Mr. Hardy would have had to address that particular issue, the issue of whether or not several of the lines that were requested were not actually approved by the court.
So even if the application says, we want 20 locations, and the court says, fine, and then other information develops regarding the location, et cetera, which telephone company is going to install this, all those types of things, that's also covered under the seal of the order?
To the extent it's not, and in this case I would submit that it is covered.
Because Mr. Hardy says so?
Well, it's his declaration, yes. And to the extent that there were lines that were not incorporated, that's not part of the declaration.
No, I'm just dealing with Mr. Hardy's declaration now. I've finished with my hypothetical.
Okay.
But I'm trying to understand what Mr. Hardy's telling us.
That any that the requested lines were approved by the Penn Register order. And he's not distinguishing between lines that may have been requested in the application, not.
I'm with you. All right. You asked for 20. The judge approved 20.
Okay.
But the judge doesn't know anything about, and we're talking in old terms, Sprint or AT&T, MCI, who's going to do this, when they're going to do it, how long.
Okay.
None of that is in the application. None of that is in the sealed order. Yet Mr. Hardy's declaration suggests that the government is reading the statute to allow non-disclosure of this post-order information or information that's not included in the order.
Well, the statute described the order as authorizing or approving the installation and use, so it would be approving the application. And so to the extent it approves the entirety of the application, we would submit as part of the sealing order. And to disclose that additional application information would be to reveal the information that cannot be disclosed, the existence of an order. It is possible that part of it in another case maybe wasn't approved by the court, in which case there may be another exemption that the judge...
No, you keep wanting to go back to my hypothetical.
Okay.
I'm trying to stick with this case now as to exactly what is subject to non-disclosure under your reading of the Penn Register Act.
Well, to turn to prong two, which specifically talks about the third parties that are subject, that may not disclose, subject to non-disclosure, they're described as person owning or leasing the line, as the court indicated, and also any person who is obligated by the order to provide assistance to the applicant. So the applicant would be the government in this case. So it would extend to those particular lines that are approved, and any disclosure of those lines would be subject to the sealing order. That would be the government's position. So that Mr. Hardy correctly withheld all of the information described in the declaration.
So when he says that, I'm sorry, I didn't mean
it. Go ahead.
Just to continue on this theme, when he says in the affidavit of paragraph 73, details surrounding FBI SA's making arrangements to set up and install a pen register and trap and trace device, then what you're saying is the way to construe that language is that those details are the kinds of details that would tell us or disclose to the public where what line the pen register was installed in.
Absolutely. And it would implicate prong two because of the participation of the owners or leasers of the line and any third party that would have to provide assistance to the applicant.
Mm-hmm.
So any arrangements to set up and install would necessarily disclose the information that cannot, the existence of the pen register and use of it as well. If there are no further questions on the pen register, I'll turn briefly to the grand jury exemption three. In this case, the material that was withheld was subject to grand jury subpoenas. Specific records, indeed, that were provided to a federal grand jury in response to the subpoena. So this is not a case where there are exhibits that were presented to the grand jury within the 302s or material obtained pursuant to search warrants that may have an independent existence. The very documents here were produced subject to the authority of the grand jury through subpoenas returnable to the grand jury. Clearly, the release of this information would reveal, as the district court found, the strategy or direction of the investigation.
So you're saying the documents were created in response to the grand jury subpoena?
They were produced, presumably, but not necessarily. Well,
then I don't understand how we can know that they don't have an independent existence, because the documents that's produced, unless I'm misunderstanding the procedure, a document that's produced in response to a subpoena could be a document that exists out there already.
Absolutely.
Right.
But it's not a case where the prosecutor presented exhibits to the grand jury. This is material subpoenaed by the grand jury itself through the government, the prosecutors, and attorney advisor, likely. But in any event, it is generated through the grand jury. It's not something presented.
Suppose the grand jury subpoenas the calendar of the U.S. Congress. Clearly, that has an independent existence.
Correct. But the very fact that the grand jury subpoenaed that to reveal that particular document would reveal, for whatever reason, that would reveal the strategy or direction of the grand jury, and therefore...
So the independent existence doctrine has no play under grand jury subpoena?
It would tend, and we would submit in this case, to reveal the strategy or direction of the grand jury, and I believe...
How? Because if it has an independent existence and it doesn't, when the disclosure, suppose a bunch of stuff is disclosed, including the congressional calendar.
Right.
If the person to whom it's disclosed has no indication on the face of the document that it was in response to a grand jury subpoena, then how is it going to reveal anything about a grand jury?
Well, in this case, you know, the parameters, if, for example, phone records were subpoenaed or bank records or something, the statements that were subpoenaed, the date, the time frame, the information that is specified in the grand jury subpoena and then reflected in the documents that are produced and returned to the grand jury would certainly reveal the strategy or direction.
Why? I'm not understanding, because if the documents have an independent existence and nothing in the disclosure of them necessarily tells you that they were the subject of a grand jury subpoena, why would the FOIA requester suppose that they had anything to do with a grand jury?
Well, the request is to the government, and if the government, in this case the FBI, in reviewing its investigative files, finds grand jury material and material returnable by a subpoena, it is entitled to withhold that information because of 6E.
No, but
That's the question.
Why is it entitled? Because if the government has the document already for some other entirely independent reason having nothing to do with the grand jury subpoena, search warrant.
Okay.
The document's already in the government's possession. And then it also happens that it's responsive to a grand jury subpoena. Are you saying that any time that something that's in the government's possession is responsive to a grand jury subpoena, then the government can invoke the grand jury exemption and say that we don't have to disclose it any longer?
Well, in the example the court had, if the government has a copy that of material that it obtained by a search warrant,
right,
or public records or something,
right,
those are available from a different source or the same source. If that material, if information is obtained through a grand jury subpoena, the material returned to the grand jury should not be disclosed. If the government has it in a separate location.
But we're talking about the same material. It's the same document. It just happens that it's also within the fold of a grand jury subpoena.
Then the government would be required to turn over the material that wasn't returned to the grand jury. Okay, it's not immunizing. The government can't return it to the grand jury as an exhibit and then take a document that by itself in the government's possession would be disclosable and say, well, we can't disclose that because it happened to be a grand jury exhibit. That's not what we have.
How do we know that? How do we know that's not what we have? Because all the declaration says is that the records were provided in response to subpoenas, which is equally true of records that otherwise exist, but they just happen to be provided in response to subpoenas.
Well, if the government had these records and then got a grand jury subpoena to get them for whatever reason, then the government would be required to turn over the first set of documents, but not the material that was provided pursuant to the subpoena. That would be the government's position.
And so, I guess my question is, how do we know, looking at the declaration, that that's not exactly what's going on? Because all the declaration tells us is that we're withholding the documents because the records were provided in response to grand jury subpoenas. And that's equally true of a situation in which there's independent possession of the records. Those records are provided in response to a grand jury subpoena. And this could be read to say, but we're still withholding them because there happened to be a grand jury subpoena that requested those documents.
But there's no indication in the declaration that the government already had the records independent of the grand jury, in which case those materials would be disclosable. If the search warrant materials, for example, if the government then subpoenaed them, for whatever reason, to get an official copy that they may want to use with a certification that they're authentic?
All that may be true, but the declaration doesn't tell us that. All it says it was produced. So the FOIA request is give me all information about Joe Jones that you have. And one of the things you have is a search warrant. And that search warrant was subject to a grand jury subpoena. So you release the search warrant. It doesn't say anything about what the grand jury was looking into.
Correct. To use an example that Judge Srinivasan had, if the government took the documents returnable by the grand jury and scanned them and put them on a PDF and stamped them returnable by grand jury subpoena, I believe the concession, those would be protected.
Yeah.
So in this case, the fact that that wasn't done, but those documents in the records of the FBI were returnable by grand jury subpoena, that's what Mr. Hardy describes, the mere fact that they weren't stamped as an additional step does not render them disclosable. The government wouldn't have an obligation to pour through grand jury material and put it in another stack so that it's not mixed in with the grand jury material the government would submit. So in this case, the fact that, as we read the declaration, they're not stamped subject to a grand jury subpoena or obtained through a grand jury subpoena, but the material was, in fact, obtained through a subpoena. And we would submit that it's subject to 6E and not to be disclosed.
Okay, let me just frame it out just 1 second. So page JA94, paragraph 74 of Hardy's declaration, that's where the grand jury issue comes up. And in the sentence towards the middle of that paragraph that begins specifically in describing the things that are not disclosed, specifically the investigative files contain, and then you go to the last clause, copies of specific records provided to a federal grand jury in response to a federal grand jury subpoenas.
Correct.
So copies of specific records provided. Now, when I read that, it just reads to me like these are copies of specific records that were provided in response to a federal grand jury subpoena. We might otherwise have copies of those records, too, but we don't have to disclose them because they were provided to a federal grand jury in response to a federal grand jury subpoena. You could say that about a search warrant, right?
You could, perhaps not artful. The indication here, as I read it, is copies are a single set of documents provided to a grand jury in response to a subpoena, not records that were independently available from some other source that the government happened to also have a copy of.
Well, let's assume that's not what the language compels, then what's your answer? In other words,
given that hypothetical, if there is...
No, given the language of the... He says copies of specific records were provided to the grand jury in response to federal grand jury subpoenas. Copies of documents.
Well,
not originals, not singular, copies. That's correct. What we're trying to understand, how far this goes.
Well, the originals of the records may not have been provided in response to the subpoena. I would assume, based on the language here, I would read it that copies were provided in response to the subpoena, and the copies are what are being withheld, that there is not an original or some other documents that separately exist.
So in this computer age, where you look at the FBI computer directories, and you scan a name in, and you see search warrant issued 2014.
Right.
And it tells you where to find it.
Right.
And it happens to be in a box that says these documents were submitted to the grand jury, and you find it. And it doesn't say anything about the grand jury in the document itself. The document is not stamped grand jury, but still no obligation to turn it over under 6E.
I believe given that hypothetical, if the records reflected that information was obtained pursuant to a search warrant, which is not exercising using the power of the grand jury, the return of the search warrant material would not be subject to 6E.
Mm-hmm.
If that same material were presented as an exhibit to a grand jury, then we get into the Senate of Puerto Rico case. Mm-hmm. And I think that's why I make the distinction between the process used here, a grand jury subpoena in obtaining the material. It is coming from a source, or not a source, it is being obtained through the grand jury using its power. Material that may be gotten from other sources, that indication of that language in the FBI records would signal that there is an independent source and that the government would have records not limited to the material provided to the grand jury.
So your position would be that if the grand jury asked for a document combining several records, for example, that would be something newly created for the grand jury in response to its subpoena.
Correct, and that would certainly reveal the direction and thinking of the grand jury if they're asking to combine.
But if each of those documents was on your computer base in connection with criminal files, then they would be individually releasable?
Unless subject to some other exemption.
Yeah, right.
Unless subject to some other exemption.
Okay.
Now, you kind of just follow on real quickly, even as to the combined document that was hypothesized by Judge Rogers' question, if the disclosure of that document wouldn't reveal that it was created or produced in response to a grand jury subpoena, then would you still say that it comes within the fold of the exemption? In other words, you could look at the document, you just look at the document on its face, it doesn't tell you anything about a grand jury.
True. If the agents obtained material, public sources, subpoena, search warrants, at that point it's not grand jury. If it's used as an exhibit or if it's subpoenaed through the grand jury, then we run into exemption 3.
But even if it's used as an exhibit, the exhibit itself doesn't tell you. If all you saw was, if there were a cover on it that says grand jury response, tab A of grand jury response, if you have that whole document, then of course, I think everybody agrees that
right.
The government can't be required to disclose that because that would tell you exactly what the grand jury is looking at. But if all you looked at was what's in the tab, and it doesn't say anything, there's no cover that says grand jury on it, there's no header that says grand jury on it on the document itself, it's just literally the tab, which is just a compilation of documents.
True.
Then that wouldn't reveal that, there would be no revealing that that has some connection to the grand jury investigation.
That's true. In this, that's not this case, we would submit, but.
Okay.
The last point, and I'll be very brief on the exclusion, the district court employed a well-established procedure of accepting an in-camera ex parte declaration in response to an allegation, a speculative allegation, that the government invoked a statutory exclusion. That this court has not ruled on that procedure in the context of exclusions, but the Sixth and Third Circuit have.
Why would we say anything about it in this case? A little advisory opinion?
I agree. There's really no reason in this particular case, and the district court reviewed the material and found no exclusion. The government will submit on its paper and ask that the court affirm the district court judgment below.
All right, thank you. All right. Why don't you take 2 minutes, Mr. Light?
Thank you. Let me start with the grand jury portion. This court's been pretty clear about what is required in the Washington Post case that I cite in my reply brief. This court says that the documents themselves need to reveal the inner workings. So how do we know here that the documents themselves would reveal the inner workings? We don't know that they were stamped. We don't know anything about the contents of them. The only thing we know is that they were subpoenaed by a grand jury. And if that were the case, that was enough to exclude them or to make them exempt, then this would cover virtually everything that this court has not construed the statute in that way. With respect to the pen register, there are, I think, a lot of difficult line drawing questions about what exactly is going to count under the Penn Register statute if the court finds it to be an Exemption 3 statute, such as what's in the application versus what's in the order, what about an FBI document that incorporates the same information. We would suggest that if the court doesn't need to decide all of those today. It's fairly straightforward here. We're talking about an FBI document that is not the order, that contains information, hard to say exactly what it is, but perhaps of the nature of how they would go about installing the device on the line. Any of that kind of information, if the government has concerns about that, revealing an ongoing investigation could be withheld under 7A. If it's information that would reveal law enforcement techniques could be revealed under 7E. What we're dealing with here is a very narrow category of things that neither of those exemptions were asserted for, and there is no discernible reason that the statute would prohibit that information from being released.
Thank you.